The title of today's program on Inside the Black Box is God's Particle. And my guest is Mark Merlin, physicist by training. But Mark, you spent much of your time programming software?
That's right. Most of all my career was a software developer.
Is that because it paid better than being a physicist?
It was easier than being a physicist.
Okay, so we're not going to admit that to to Jasper County High School, who's going to be sitting in on today's program, where we'll be talking about God's particle, I guess, right? The God particle. It used to be called the God blank particle by physicists because they're not big fans of that name,
That's
are they?
That's right.
Right, so we'll refer to it as the Higgs boson, ladies and gentlemen. That's next up on Inside the Black Box, science only funnier.
Hey, Amit, we got to do a new promo.
Ah, that time of year.
You can choose the music, though. What would you like to hear?
Something with cake.
New Sea and Cake just came in.
That sounds awesome. Thrill Jockey.
All right, let me pull that up.
Lost in the Stacks is the one and only research library rock and roll radio show. Each Friday at noon, Amit and Charlie from the Georgia Tech Library pick a theme and free associate an hour of music, interviews, and library talk.
You'll hear indie rock, pop rock, alt rock, new wave, and the occasional oddity that one of us pulls out of the vault in between interviews with students, faculty, and librarians.
That's Lost in the Stacks on WREK Atlanta every Friday at noon right here on 91.1 FM.
You're listening to Boring Havanagila. For the best Jewish and Israeli music this far from the Holy Land, try Kosher Noise with your host DJ Meltz, Monday nights from 7 to 8 p.m. And now back to your regularly scheduled program.
The opinions expressed on Inside the Black Box do not reflect those of WREK Radio or the Georgia Institute of Technology.
I live on a street near the university. Are you getting this, kid? Don't know if I did.
Welcome to Inside the Black Box, a weekly program on science and technology, or as we like to think of it, science, only funnier. I'm Pete Ludovis, and today joining me in studio is my guest, Mark Merlin, to talk about the Higgs boson. Do you get more leverage if you say it like the Higgs, you know, what is it, new this fall from 20th Century Fox, it's the Higgs boson. I don't know. I guess it's tough to get theoretical physics in the Standard Model exciting enough for the public? Is that a challenge, Mark?
Well, you know, it's funny because there's been a lot of excitement about the Higgs boson.
Finally.
So, you know, it surprised me. A talk that I planned on giving once, I've given four times.
Mm-hmm.
So it's quite popular.
And this is actually something you've given for the Atlanta Science Tavern.
That's right. That's the organization that I'm the director of. It's a grassroots public science forum in Atlanta. It's organized on meetup.com. And we have over 2,500 members now.
Right, and you're doing a heck of a job with that. We'll talk a little bit more about the Science Tavern and hopefully the upcoming, we're having a thing.
Atlanta Science Festival.
The Atlanta Science Festival.
Proposed Atlanta Science Festival for 2014.
Right. So it's called the Science Tavern. So our high school students joining us in Jasper County at the behest of their teacher, Tyson Hardy. Science Tavern, is that something they could or should or would go to?
Well, I mean, I think with parents' permission, they could. We certainly have lots of high school students attend.
Oh, okay. Great.
And our main venue is a pub, which serves food and alcohol, but kids are welcome.
Is the Higgs boson lecture better after you've had a couple of pints?
I think almost every lecture is probably better after you've had a couple of pints.
All right, kids, when you get to college, remember that. All lectures, physics or otherwise. That's true of stand-up comedy as well. We always like people to be properly lubricated when they do that. But before we get into the Higgs boson, Mark is an Atlanta native. And a product of the Atlanta public school system.
That's right.
Is that a source of pride nowadays?
I'm
from the public school system as well.
It is. Atlanta public school system's had gone through rough times, but they're there are a lot of good things to be said for it.
So you got your bachelor's degree in physics from Emory University,
right.
Went ahead and got a master's degree at University of Pennsylvania, where you actually worked in theoretical physics, right?
Oh, it was experimental particle physics.
Ah, okay. And you actually spent a little time at Fermilab out in northern Illinois.
That's right, just outside of Chicago.
Yeah. And Fermilab, actually, we have Eric Prebis is sort of one of our resident physicists who comes on to talk about these things from Fermilab. I mean, Fermilab's still sort of jockeying for position with the CERN Large Hadron Collider to produce interesting results.
Sad to say, that's no longer the case. The, the main beam at Fermilab shut down last year, at least for ongoing particle physics research. There are still things going on there.
Okay.
But CERN and the Large Hadron Collider has taken the lead. It is now the premier and pretty much the only game in town as far as high-energy particle physics.
So a lot of people worry about this, right? We had the super collider planned for Texas a decade or two ago. We cut the funding for that. I was actually out at Brookhaven National Labs using their synchrotron light source, and they had the tunnel for an accelerator that was built decades ago.
That's right.
That they never finished.
That's right.
Are we now, you know, lagging behind the world in terms of experimental
physics?
Actually,
I don't see it that way at all. I think that what's happened is that these machines have become so large. For example, the Large Hadron Collider, the construction costs were $10 billion.
Right.
That it really doesn't pay to duplicate them.
Mm-hmm.
And that what used to be the province of a single nation, very, very rich single nation like the United States, is now a shared responsibility by all nations of the world.
But a lot of people would claim that the United States probably isn't as involved as they could be, both monetarily and maybe not for the Large Hadron Collider and other experiments at CERN. CERN's got a lot of things. But there's a big fusion experiment in France now where we're barely 5%.
Right. There's I think it's ITER, which is an international experimental fusion reactor.
Right.
I'm not quite sure. I think that the United States is actually pretty involved with the LHC and experiments there. But it's involved probably in proportion to its financial capabilities the way other countries are too.
Okay.
I think what we're seeing now is much more of a collaborative international environment where everybody participates as they can.
And that's a good thing.
I think that's a
good
thing.
Okay, good. Well, that's good to hear. So before we get into the details of the Standard Model and the Higgs boson, let's begin the program, as we often do, with...
Science in the News.
And today's Science in the News comes from Wired Magazine, the October issue of Wired Magazine. It's an article by their editor-in-chief, Chris Anderson, entitled "The New MakerBot Replicator Might Just Change Your World." All right, just by show of hands for our folks in Jasper County, how many of you guys read Wired Magazine? Can they hear me? Okay, I'm getting a lot of laughter. You guys don't read Wired Magazine? I thought Wired Magazine... What do you mean no one I subscribe to Wired Magazine. What are you saying? I'm not hip. I'm out of touch. Trent Altman, our engineer, ladies and gentlemen, apparently claiming I'm clueless. I was trying to pick a hip Science and News, you know, for the youngsters out there, right?
I think you picked a hip Science and the News magazine, but you didn't pick a you didn't pick a hip magazine.
Oh, okay. All right. So according to Wired Magazine, there's this new the MakerBot. And the MakerBot is designed and manufactured in the Bot Cave. The Bot Cave is the home of MakerBot, a company that for 4 years has been bringing affordable 3D printers to the masses. But nothing MakerBot has ever built looks like the new printer these workers are currently constructing. It's the Replicator 2. It's priced at a little over $2,000. Actually uses polylactic acid as its resin. And you can make just about anything with this thing. You can get almost any form of a CAD file. They have their own applications that will do this as well. And the author of the article, Chris Anderson, and this was actually adapted from one of his books, says, now the printers are a heck of a lot more reliable. At his house, the killer app for the MakerBot has been toys, dollhouse furniture, board game pieces, models, print, paint, and play. And free design libraries like MakerBot's own Thingiverse and equivalents from Tinkercad and Autodesk mean that you can get files to make just about anything. And last year, MakerBot raised $10 million from investors, including Amazon founder Jeff Bezos, to fund its expansion. And I think there's no coincidence there, right? I mean, the future that these guys are looking at is just like old geezers like me now will download an Avery template for labels, right? You know, if you're going to print labels.
Nobody prints labels.
I print labels. I sell T-shirts online. I print labels. With the vicious attacks.
All right.
I mean, not enough caffeine this morning?
I don't know.
Okay. So you can actually get files to print stuff out of, you know, relatively, not really strong resins, right? And that is the big limit of these things, that, you know, a good injection molding always gives you better mechanical properties than these. But if you're going to, say, go to Dragon Con, right, which we've talked about before on this program, and you could actually take a picture of someone there, you could turn into an avatar that looks like Homer Simpson or, you know, Peter Griffin from The Family Guy, and print out chess pieces or little models or action figures that kind of look like that avatar of that person. I think that's the real application. But for me, I now think that, you know, as these things get better and better, the real application will be for anyone who owns a cell phone. All right, so show of hands from our Jasper County High School students. How many people have a cell phone? Raise your hand if you have a cell phone. Yeah, it's just about everybody there, right? I mean, my son just turned 13, and he's like, Dad, I have to have a cell phone. I'm not sure I'm convinced yet. But and the problem is every time you get a new cell phone, I just got a new one because I broke mine in Houston, Texas when I was on the road. You have to buy a new clip for your belt, a new clip for your car, and you know, all these accessories that don't fit the old cell phone. That might be a really interesting application where you will print out of polystyrene or something like that the new clip that holds it on the holder for my car so I can use my GPS. Because I hate paying $49 for that sort of stuff. And $49 is actually similar to the price where you can buy a kilogram of resin. So you could make a few chess sets and a lot of holders and things like that. The only thing I want to point out is, you know, I hate to point out people's mistakes here, but the author article talks about, you know, in his dentist office, you get these Invisalign brand, you know, plates to move your teeth. Those are actually made with photolithography, where a laser scans across and cures usually a methacrylate resin. That's actually very expensive, very reliable. My understanding is with the new MakerBots, these actually extrude resin. So you can change the material a lot, and it's a lot cheaper, but the mechanical properties aren't that great. But I'm starting to believe now, only because I have to buy new accessories for my cell phone, this will be the big app. And again, it's no coincidence that Amazon is funding this, because you'll buy the CAD file from Amazon.com, like you buy templates and digital music and stuff like that, and eventually do that. So show of hands from our Jasper High School folks. Would anyone be interested in a two-dimensional printer to make weird stuff?
It's a three-dimensional printer.
Or sorry, three-dimensional. Two-dimensional. That's my generation. All right, we got a lot of takers, so there it is. It's a very unscientific survey, but nonetheless, at least high school students anecdotally appear to be interested in that. So, Mark, let's shift back to the Higgs boson, and I guess we need to understand the standard model.
Okay.
What is the standard model?
Well, you know, it's funny, looking in the classroom there, maybe the students could tell me, is that a periodic table on the back wall?
Looks like it. Yeah, periodic table on the back.
I think that's probably a great way to think about the standard model. The wonderful thing about the periodic table, and I imagine that everybody in the classroom knows about this, and that is it really simplified our understanding of the world, at least in the 19th century. We had all these substances and metals and organic and living materials, and they were really almost countless. There were probably too many that could to name. And that by very careful work, I guess starting in the previous century, but by the middle of the 19th century, people realized that a lot of that complexity could be explained by imagining that the things that we see in the world are constructed from a more limited number of simple objects, things that we call atoms now. And it really brought a kind of order and explanatory capability to science that had been lacking for years. So the diversity and the complexity of the world that we experience was reduced down, I think, now to 90. There are 92 naturally occurring elements and some that have been created by scientists. And I think this is really the program of modern physics, and that is to take a more careful look at the world around us, but at an even smaller level than atoms and molecules, and ask, what is the periodic table that from which we can build everything in the universe. Mm-hmm. And the standard model is really a proposal as to what the components of that very, very fundamental periodic table are.
And if you read Green's book, The Elegant Universe, he actually puts it in terms of tables, of classifications of types of subatomic particles.
That's right. And as far as... As the standard model goes relative to the periodic table, there's actually fewer components. Mm-hmm. There's really two classes of particles that compose matter. One are called quarks, and there are a half dozen of them. And quarks are the things that make up protons and neutrons mm-hmm. that we know compose the nuclei of atoms. And then there is a class or particle called leptons, which includes the electron. And we know that from chemistry. It orbits nuclei, and it's really responsible for light and chemical reactions mm-hmm. as we
experience. And would be quarks, and quarks would be an example of a hadron?
Quarks are example of a class of particle called hadrons. Or actually, they combine into class of particles mm-hmm. Called hadrons. And the electron is... part of the class of particles called leptons. And the only one that the students might be aware of, and it's more mysterious, is a particle called the neutrino. Have you guys heard of neutrinos before? Any show of hands? Neutrinos? Neutrinos are...
The teacher has.
That's a good sign. The best way to think of a neutrino, I think, is it's basically an electron that's been stripped of its charge.
Right.
It's almost massless. And because it's almost massless, it moves at very close to the speed of light. And it only interacts through what's called the weak interaction. So the standard model really posits two categories of building blocks for matter. And those are quarks and leptons. And it also identifies four particles that are responsible for the interactions between the other two categories of particles. And these are called force carriers or interaction particles, and they're responsible for the kinds of forces we see in the world, and that would be electricity and magnetism, which is probably the most common force, and then two less common forces. One is called the strong interaction, and it's responsible for holding the nuclei of atoms together, and then the weak force, which is responsible for radioactive decay. So the standard model really only consists of three total components. There's quarks and leptons for matter, and then there's force-carrying particles that really hold everything together.
So what would the particles be for the electromagnetic force?
The particle for the electromagnetic force, the particle of light, is called the photon. And this is something that might be familiar. It's something that we encounter in science fiction and... Star Trek photon torpedoes and mm-hmm. things like that. But a photon was actually proposed by Albert Einstein in 1905 in order to explain something called the photoelectric effect. And it was one of the first insights that Einstein and other scientists at the era had that energy came in discrete packets called mm-hmm. quanta. And so the photon was the quantum of the electromagnetic force. The other force carriers have more or less interesting names. The carrier that is responsible for holding protons and neutrons together, since they're bound so tightly, has the interesting name gluon, because it really glues things together quite well. The carriers of the weak force have less interesting names. They're just called the W and the Z boson.
Mm-hmm. And is the graviton part of the standard model?
Well, that's a very interesting question, because the standard model, to some extent, advertises itself as a theory of everything.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing it doesn't include is gravity, so it's hardly a theory of everything if it doesn't include gravity. The fact of the matter is that no one really knows how to reconcile gravity and quantum mechanics yet, mm-hmm. and that's probably on the forefront of most theoretical and some experimental research. So the standard model of physics is basically a model of the universe absent such things as gravity, but there are other important right. things that are missing too. Right.
Okay. All right, well, let's take a quick break, but when we come back, we'll talk with Mark about Higgs. Who was Higgs? The Higgs field, the Higgs boson, and the upcoming Higgs action figure. We'll be right back with Inside the Black Box. Science, only funnier.
The following is a public service announcement brought to you by the staff of WRAK Atlanta. The average American uses 650 pounds of paper each year. 100 million tons of wood could be saved each year if all that paper was recycled. You can help keep our forest green. Visit keepatlantabeautiful.org to find out more information and to find a recycling center near you.
The North Avenue Lounge is WREK's interview show. Every Monday at noon, you can hear a conversation with almost anyone. Artists, writers, professors, students, scientists, engineers, musicians, and other fascinating people from Georgia Tech and elsewhere. We've talked about everything from building an astrophysics lab to dancing ballet to being a blacksmith. Tune in each Monday at noon to hear an interesting conversation about almost anything on the North Avenue Lounge, right here on WREK Atlanta.
You believe in WREK?
I believe in WREK.
Welcome back to Inside the Black Box, where we're talking with Mark Merlin about the Higgs boson. So who was Higgs, his field, his particle? What's the story?
Well, Peter Higgs was one of several researchers in the 1960s who was struggling with a question that actually wasn't related to the Standard Model at the time, but became a very important key to making the Standard Model work. And as I've said, the Standard Model is, offers all the building blocks for much of the universe. And the question is, well, why do we need anything else? And the problem really was a theoretical problem, and that is that the way the theories of physics worked, the quarks and the leptons and the force carriers all made sense mathematically, but they only made sense mathematically if none of them had any mass.
Mm-hmm.
And what Higgs came up with, and it's actually called the Higgs mechanism, is a way to take those simple components and come up and make a mathematical theory that still worked. And the result was is the elementary particles in the theory acquired mass as a result of this Higgs mechanism. And the particle that was designated to create that type of mass was actually named after Higgs, Peter Higgs.
And that's the Higgs boson.
That's a Higgs boson.
Okay. And what about the Higgs boson? Is the Higgs boson chargeless? Is it? What are its properties?
Well, it's very simple to describe in that respect. It has no charge, and it has zero spin. In physics, particle physics, every particle has some sort of intrinsic spin, and they either come in integer quantities, and those particles are called bosons. So they could have spin zero or spin one or spin two, or they can have half integral spin, and those particles are called fermions. So the Higgs boson is a spin zero particle with zero charge, but it turns out that it's quite massive. In fact, many, many times the mass of a proton or a neutron.
So now, is that, in fact, why it was so difficult to discover? Because of the interconversion of mass and energy?
Well, I think it was a combination of things that made the Higgs difficult to discover. The accelerators, even Fermilab, they had been looking for it for years, had enough energy to produce the Higgs, which turns out to have a mass of about 140 or 150 times a proton mass. The problem is that Higgs is sort of reclusive, and it's hard to produce, and you need to have lots of collisions in order to, by accident, create a Higgs.
So what you're saying is to get that much energy to create one of these particles is not the obstacle. It's that it's a rare event.
It's a rare event, and you really, it's a needle in the haystack kind of problem. Okay. And the search at the Large Hadron Collider to find the Higgs was really an effort to find that needle in a haystack of competing similar interactions that the the accelerator produced.
Right. So the point is, you're slamming these hadrons together very close to the speed of light, producing huge amounts of energy. What comes off of it is all sorts of secondary particles,
lots and lots of different things.
But what you're saying is, given the mechanism by which this happens, it's very rare to get the Higgs boson.
That's right. It's very rare, and since the Higgs boson is very short-lived, its lifetime is on the order of 10 to the minus 24 seconds.
Mm, okay.
It's never observed directly. When you think about that type of lifetime, even moving at the speed of light, the Higgs boson doesn't traverse the diameter of a proton before it decays.
Wow.
So the only way you can detect the Higgs is to look for what you expect to be the decay products when it finally does decay into other particles.
And did the Standard Model or some theory relevant to that tell us what those decay particles were?
That's exactly right. There were some very clear signals that the Higgs should have produced. One of the decay modes, which is really the one that was most prominent, had to do with particles we've already talked about, the photon, and that is that one of the decay chains for the Higgs leads to two very high energy photons, and mm-hmm. this is one of the signals that was detected.
Oh, okay.
At CERN. The problem is that there are other competing processes that also yield two very high energy protons. So it became a numbers game, and that is that the people at CERN had to find an excess event over the expected number of interactions that yielded two high energy protons.
Okay, so this is sort of like you've got this collision, it produces a large number of high energy photons, and what you want to see is a tiny increase in that number of high energy photons.
That's exactly right. And the problem is that it's like we know that tossing a coin, it's a 50-50 chance, but we know that on any given 10 or 20 or 100 coin tosses, we don't get an exact 50% division
because
there are fluctuations that are due to chance.
Right.
And so given the fact that there are only a few numbers of excess events that were expected above the so-called background two-photon events, they had to produce enough events that they were convinced that the excess wasn't just a mistake or an error or a statistical fluctuation.
So a good example of this might actually be, you mentioned before, the neutrino, right? And neutrinos are very, very difficult to see. We've had a couple physicists on the program before. One looks at them at very high altitude. Another one looks at them in a cubic mile of ice in Antarctica. Because unlike an electron, it hits us, it's so small, and again, we were talking during the break, small is an irrelevant term. It's really the cross-section. It's the probability of smacking into something.
That the strength of the interaction.
Yes, is very, very small. And then because it's not an electron, electrons find something of similar or opposite charge. They get pushed into something.
That's right.
Neutrino passes right through the planet most of the time without any interaction.
Right. I think the rule of thumb is that a neutrino will go through four light years of lead without interacting with a 50% chance of interacting.
So given the neutrinos that hit the South Pole, you're waiting around for a long, long time to see one smack into this cubic mile of ice and give us something, telltale signs.
That's right.
Okay. So given that, why would anyone go into high-energy experimental physics? I'm looking at these students, they're thinking, well, I'm not doing this, whatever it is.
Well, I mean, I mean, it's a great question. It really has to do with whether you're driven by wanting to know the very most fundamental answers to what
which
the
I think is fascinating.
What the universe is made of. I mean, this is what high-energy physics is all about. And I'll probably depart from a lot of the people who try to popularize this, but there are no applications for stuff.
That was going to be my next question.
I mean, there are spinoffs, of course. Mm-hmm. There are wonderful superconducting magnets that have been devised in order to make this accelerator work. And the amount of data that is produced is enormous, and there's an entire computing grid that's been developed in order to process it. But we will never have products in our everyday life that involve the production or use of Higgs bosons.
But that's okay, right? Because if you think about it, when quantum mechanics was first discovered, people were like, okay. But now we use it in spectroscopy that does lab tests when you go to the doctor. Even Einstein's relativity, right? We think relativity, who really cares? but your GPS would not work if it weren't for relativistic corrections in the satellites that manage
it. I think that's probably the best exception. But the thing that has to be kept in mind is that even though we didn't discover the electron until the latter part of the 19th century, the 1890s, I believe, electrons were all around us.
Right.
They were unnamed and unrecognized. And the world that we lived in, whether we knew it or not, involved electrons pervasively.
Right.
But the world we live in, other than the fact that the Higgs boson gives certain particles mass, doesn't involve Higgs bosons at all. So it's hard to come up with a way that they're going to be important.
And so is the way the Higgs boson gives things mass, because is it its relation to the Higgs field that sort of acts like this viscous drag on other particles?
That's exactly right. The metaphor, although it's somewhat reversed, in that it's the Higgs field that gives mass. And this is the genius of Peter Higgs, and that is that he had to come up with a theory that took particles that were largely indistinguishable for one another and figure out how to make some of them heavier and some of them lighter and some of them not acquire mass at all.
Right.
And he figured out that if the universe were pervaded by a field of particles, he didn't call them Higgs particles, of course, at the time.
Right, right.
And that, let's say, electrons preferentially interacted with this field more than photons do.
Right, right.
And then protons even more so, or quarks even more so. Then trying to traverse the field, some particles would find their velocity slowed because of the nature of this interaction with the field, and some would just pass through unimpeded. And that was the genius of the Higgs mechanism.
Right. So will this discovery in any way, even if it's many, many decades down the road, impact, you know, our understanding of the new mysterious things about the universe? Dark matter, dark energy, does it interact with string theory at all? Or
That's the great question. I think this is where all the money is now, and that is that the Higgs...
There's money in physics?
Well, yeah, there's an enormous amount, and because the Large Hadron Collider's got a lot of other things to explain, too. And so if it were a $10 billion investment only to discover the Higgs, then some people might think that that probably wasn't worth it. But the fact of the matter is we mentioned already that gravity isn't accounted for in the standard model. Well, it turns out that, as you referred to, dark energy, which is a substance that's only been known for about 14 years, that's causing the universe to expand at an ever-increasing rate, and then dark matter, which has been known for about 70 years, and it's responsible for keeping galaxies intact and in orbit, that these things aren't accounted for by the standard model at all.
Right. So we have a long way to go, because right now we're at that point where I wonder if anyone's taking anybody seriously, because we're sort of like, well, you know, galaxies move and the universe is expanding, and oh, well, we can use dark matter to explain why it's not as fast or falling apart, and then we can use dark energy to explain why it's really accelerating more than we think. Sounds like a fudge factor, a made-up constant.
Well, I think it is. I mean, until we actually understand the constitution of dark energy and dark matter, it is a fudge factor. Okay. It's a working hypothesis.
Yeah.
But physicists are very dissatisfied with just saying galaxies are held together
by dark matter.
And so one of the primary questions for the Large Hadron Collider and other experiments that are going on, and that is there a particle that's actually responsible for what we're calling dark matter, and what are the specific properties of that particle? And the standard model says nothing about that at all.
Wow. Okay, so it's all about the fundamentals, which we're excited about on this program here.
We are.
But for our Jasper County High School students, if you're thinking, hey, this will help me get a high-paying job and move out of mom and dad's basement, maybe not in the immediate future, but that's something you got to think about, right? So there are people that live in the world and do what they do just because they like it. And you can still do okay.
Yeah, they're called scientists.
Right, that's exactly it.
They're mathematicians.
Right, many of us do work on applications on the side. For Mark, it was programming computers. For me, it's putting nerdy slogans on T-shirts. But it all works out in the end.
It does.
So let's do this. Let's take a quick break. And when we come back, let's see if we've got any questions from our Jasper County students. And if we get time, maybe talk about what's happening with the Atlanta Science Tavern and the upcoming Atlanta Science Festival.
Okay.
We'll be right back with Inside the Black Box. Science, only funnier.
You know who you are. You know you have a problem. How it's all slipping away under your feet like quicksand into an agonizing vortex of lies and pain and stupidity. You know, life. Life sucks, and we understand. We're the Church of the Subgenius, and we're here with proven therapies that can help you survive your daily hell march by giving you the ability to laugh in the face of the horror. Indeed, to laugh your guts out. The Hour of Slack and Bob's Slacktime Funhouse deliver a solid two-hour dose of psychic medication to armor you against the deadly friction of your everyday existence. That's midnight Saturdays on WREK Atlanta. The Hour of Slack and Bob's Slacktime Funhouse from the Church of the Subgenius. We don't know exactly what we are, but we know for sure that we're not them.
This is your radio friend, Joe Bizard, inviting you to tune into my country music classics here on WREK at 91.1, Friday evenings at 5 o'clock. We come alive at 5 with great old-time music. String bands, bluegrass, old country blues, a little of everything, jug bands, anything that you can imagine, you'll hear on the country music classics. All happy music. A little jug band. Don't forget, this is Friday at 5. We come alive right here with the Country Music Classics on WREK-FM 91.1. Make it a habit. Tune in. I'd love to have you. That's Fridays at 5 right here on WREK 91.1.
Welcome back to Inside the Black Box. And before we take some questions from our Jasper County High School students, what about this name, the God particle?
Well, it's not a popular name for the Higgs particle, at least in the physics community. Mm-hmm. It came into being because Leon Letterman, who's a Nobel Prize winning physicist,
is not to be confused with David Letterman.
Not David Letterman, although he's a pretty much a character too, Leon is.
Okay.
He wrote a book in 1994, and they were looking for a name. And as you mentioned, the particle, the Higgs had proven very elusive, and physicists were somewhat stymied by it. And they had a less attractive name.
But it would be the edgier version of the God dang particle, because they were not happy with that. Yeah.
Right, they weren't happy because the Higgs was so hard to find, right. And I think Leon unintentionally suggested the God particle as a name to his publisher, mm-hmm. And since it had such popular currency, right. And was so successful that it got adopted as the name for the book, and it sort of stuck with the
Higgs. So it really started with this derogatory name because physicists hated this particle so much because it was so elusive.
Well, at least that's one of the stories.
Right.
Realistic, or I guess somewhat accurate aspect of the name, and that it's a very important particle,
right.
For the standard model.
Brings the universe together,
right? And it gives particles, at least some of the elementary particles, mass.
Right.
But it's been oversold. I mean, most of the mass of the proton, for example,
right.
Doesn't come from the Higgs.
Right. Right.
It comes from the gluons that actually hold the quarks together.
But has this caused problems, right? Because the popular media, the popular press, has somehow... I see people attaching mystical, faith, religious attachment to this.
That's right. I think it has caused problems because the nature of physics is not to invoke magical...
Right.
Things or supernatural,
right.
Properties are not, and not to try to replace any supernatural claims,
right.
Either. And so I think in the popular imagination, it really has confused the issue.
Okay. So physicists don't like it because of that confusion.
It's true.
Yeah. All right. So hopefully if our Jasper County High School students are still awake, at least the people in the front row have chugged a Red Bull before class. I can tell by looking at them. Any questions from the group? Mr. Hardy? Dr. Hardy, actually.
Where is he? Can I see him? Where's Tyler? Yeah, Tyler, I must say, with the shirt and the tie, you look like a young J. Willard Gibbs, the thermodynamicist. He was quite the party dude, I'm told. So go ahead. Do we have any questions from the students?
Yeah, my name is Will Wade, senior, and I was wondering how big can we make these particle colliders, and what could we find with them?
Go ahead. That's a great question. The Large Hadron Collider is 17 miles in diameter, and it's certainly the biggest machine that's been built. The one that was planned for Texas, the superconducting supercollider, was going to be actually much larger, maybe 24 or 25 miles in diameter. And that really is why they're so expensive. You have to get a lot of land, you have to tunnel beneath it, and then you have to fill it up with these very, very strong superconducting magnets, which are very expensive. And how big they can get is really up to how much money we have to spend on them and our imagination. There are proposals that someday we would put one of these things that would circle the equator of the moon.
Wow.
And that would be the convenient thing here is that since the particles need to be accelerated and in a vacuum, the vacuum comes for free.
That's a good idea.
Yeah, it's far-fetched, but the more powerful, the bigger they are, the more powerful they can be made, and the more carefully they can probe the detailed constituents of the universe, too.
But let me ask you a follow-up question on that. What does the cost scaling go like? I'm guessing it's not linear, because the bigger it is, the harder it is to evacuate it and make sure all the superconducting magnets are aligned and working properly.
Right. It's the figures of merit, and I don't have the inflation-adjusted ones, but when Fermi Lab was completed in 1972, it was at a cost of $250 million.
Wow, pretty cheap by
today's
time.
Standards. But that probably corresponds to close to $1 billion in 2012 dollars. My guess is the next accelerator could easily cost 10 times what the current one does. Mm-hmm. And it's really, at some point, they become a significant part of the national budget.
Right.
And in hard economic times, it's going to be difficult for anybody to make the case that that much money should be spent for a new one. Right. So I think the Large Hadron Collider will probably be the premier accelerator, at least for the next couple of decades.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, thanks for the question. Any other questions?
Megan Campaign, I'm a freshman, and I was wondering if the Higgs field and the fabric of space-time are related.
I didn't get that one either.
Sure. She asked if the Higgs field and then the concept of the fabric of space-time, if they're somehow related.
That's a really good question, and it's something that I didn't touch on in the description. But the way this comes about, and that is at an instant after the Big Bang, there's really no Higgs field. And the universe is very symmetric. All the particles have zero mass, and all the forces are equal. But at about a trillionth of a second after the Big Bang, the Higgs field condenses out, and it becomes really part of at least the backdrop of space-time. And it's that condensation, this appearance of a Higgs field everywhere, that preferentially couples to certain elementary particles and not to others, that actually gives mass. So Higgs isn't there from the very start, but it's there from very close to the very start, the Higgs field. Mm-hmm. And it really is this backdrop of, part of the backdrop of space-time that everything happens within.
Mm-hmm.
Good
All
question.
Right. Great. Any more questions?
Hi, my name is Ben Hart. I'm a junior. I was wondering, what really is dark matter, and is it related to the Higgs field?
Well, that's a really good question. And dark matter, not to be confused with dark energy, which is something newer and different, was more or less discovered in the 1930s, and that is that people started looking at galaxies with larger and larger telescopes, and they realized that the galaxies that were circling one another, there wasn't enough matter. It didn't appear to be enough matter there to hold them in orbit. The galaxies should be flying apart. And whatever this stuff was that was keeping the galaxies together wasn't luminous. In other words, it didn't give off light. And that's why they called it just sort of collectively dark matter. Mm-hmm. It's not clear exactly what dark matter is from the standpoint of particle physics. The interesting thing about the Higgs, and one of the interesting things about the discovery that was announced in July, and that is that if this is the Higgs, the garden variety Higgs of the standard model, then it really doesn't open up any new doors. But if it's a Higgs particle that has properties that are unanticipated in the standard mm-hmm. model, then it actually may provide a mm-hmm. connection to an explanation for the particles that are responsible mm-hmm. for dark matter. So the exciting thing about the Higgs announcement is that it may actually be opening some new doors as far as discoveries about dark matter and dark energy.
So what you're saying is now that we've found the Higgs boson, we need to take a detailed look at its properties.
That's exactly right. I mean, there's one way of looking at the Higgs, and that is that it's the last piece in the standard model puzzle. But if its properties are different than what were expected, then it may be the first piece mm-hmm. in solving the dark matter puzzle. And so right now, the job of the people at CERN is to produce more and more events and more signatures for Higgs so that by looking at how it decays, they can understand its properties better.
So with regard to dark matter, and I struggle with this as well, I mean, this is one of the more directly observable things. You can look at a galaxy, you can calculate its mass, look at the velocity of the planet, and you could relatively simply now do the calculation to say, look, those planets should be spinning off into space.
That's right.
There's got to be a piece of mass in the middle. But a lot of galaxies have black holes in the middle. Is a black hole an example of dark matter, or is it different?
No, I think that technically it's different. I think at some point in time, before black holes were understood, it might have been in that category.
Right.
But even taking the central core of galaxies into account, the black holes, when you actually just look at the deformation of the galaxy, mm-hmm. that there's sort of wobbles within individual galaxies, they can't be explained by anything that's centrally located. So it's not only dark matter, but the dark matter actually is, in some regards, may surround the galaxies.
Okay.
And I think there's some actually photographic evidence of the fact that colliding galaxies, I think it's called the bullet cluster, that the only way to explain the dynamics is that they're actually surrounded by dark matter.
So it's additional mass that changes the trajectory of these things, but they're not centralized like a black hole is.
That's right. It doesn't have to be in the center of the galaxy.
All right, I learned something new. That was good. All right, other questions? You know they're there.
Okay, I'm Levi Ford, another freshman. And I want to know what the difference is between dark matter and dark energy.
So the difference between dark matter and dark energy.
Well, dark energy, it's interesting to put these things in perspective in terms of what the accounting for all the mass energy in the universe is now. But it appears as though the mass that we're familiar with that makes up planets and people and puppy dogs and intergalactic hydrogen gas is only about 4% of all the mass energy in the universe. And another 22 or 23% is imagined to exist as dark matter. But the vast majority of the mass energy of the universe, over 70%, now is believed to reside in dark energy. And this was something that we had no idea about until 1998. And the thing about dark energy is that unlike dark matter, it doesn't seem to be responsible for holding anything together, and it's quite the contrary. We sort of knew the universe has been expanding, and we've known that since the days of Hubble investigations of galaxies back in the 20s. But what we learned in 1998 is that the universe is expanding at an increasingly rapid rate, and it's hard to come up with an explanation for that. Mm-hmm. And one explanation is to posit something, a substance called dark energy, which pervades all space and that has this repulsive gravitational influence that's pushing everything apart. In fact, pushing space apart as well.
Right. So our classical view of the universe is, you know, it's either closed, open, or neutral, but it ought to be slowing down as that gravitational force gets weaker because they're getting farther and farther apart. You integrate over that force, you get this change in energy, but there's something that's keeping it going faster than it should.
Faster than it should, and the implications are pretty astounding, and that is that if anybody in our galaxy survives for about a trillion years, when they look out into space, they won't be able to see another galaxy. And they will have actually no evidence that any other galaxies exist.
Oh, so we'll just be that far apart.
It will look like we're an island universe again.
So the starry night's gone, basically.
Well, we'll see the stars in our own galaxy.
Oh, that's right, because they're in our own galaxy. Right, we just won't see galaxies.
So, and then the astounding thing is that the expansion actually increases over time, and that at very, very distant future, space-time and all of matter will be ripped apart by dark energy.
Luckily, I won't be around for this.
Yeah, it's something we have to worry about.
So you might want to notice Mark's use of, what did you call it, mass energy, right? I mean, so get used to this annoying habit of scientists, right? If two things are interconvertible, we'll use a term for both of them,
right?
So if you think about E equals MC squared, you can convert one into the other. Not easily, mind you, but... certainly that's the case. I mean, physicists have this annoying habit, at least in my field, of to us, temperature is the amount of energy of motion in the atoms.
Right.
So most physicists won't use Celsius or Fahrenheit or Kelvin or anything like that. We'll use kilocalories. I mean, to us, that is the energy. In fact, sometimes in equations, you will write temperature as energy.
That's right.
And
in particle physics... no one quotes masses of protons or in grams. It's always in terms of their energy equivalent.
Right, exactly. So there you go. Other questions from our Jasper County students?
My name is Stephen Arena. I'm a freshman, and I would like to know why the Higgs particle is so short-lived.
That's a really good question, too. I'm not sure that I can answer it other than by saying that the nature of the particles that we know, there's only a handful that are stable. And that is that we know of protons and neutrons and electrons and neutrinos. And all the other particles, including the new types of quarks that make more exotic particles, these are produced in high-energy accelerators. And the nature of them is that none of them live very long. They decay into particles that are eventually stable. Some are more long-lived than others. And the only way to answer the question would be sort of circular. The way the physicists would answer the question is to say that a particle is short-lived because there are highly probable ways for it to decay.
Mm-hmm.
And so particles that have a way to decay basically do so. And if they have lots of ways to decay or those ways are very available to them, then they very, very short-lived. I guess in some ways it's like asking about why if you poke holes in a bucket full of water, why it pours out more quickly or less quickly. And then as the more holes there are, and the more ways there are for the water to get out, the more quickly the bucket gets emptied. And that's sort of a good analogy for why particles decay as quickly as they do.
I mean, is it fair to, at this level, invoke an entropy sort of argument that if we talk about atomic reactions, right, something is much more likely to react for two reasons. One, if the energy of the product is lower, things tend to like to go to more stable energetic systems. But if there are millions of mechanisms for it to get
there,
it's more likely to find it.
That's right. I mean, it's sort of more exits in the building, so to speak.
Right.
But it's a good question because I'm not sure that it's inconceivable that you could create a stable, heavy particle that hasn't been observed before. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's any violation of laws of physics in that regard.
Right.
So far, all of these heavier particles are increasingly short-lived. Nothing survives more than a microsecond.
Right. But, I mean, basically, I think what you're saying, Mark, is at this level of experimental physics, we're in the tail end of the actinide series of the periodic table. We're getting to the point where these are not the most stable elements to just hang around.
Right. I think that's a that's a good description. And it raises an important question, too, and that is that maybe there are just lots of particles out there of greater and greater mass or requiring greater and greater energy that we'll just never be able to create, at least using earthbound accelerators.
Right.
So we may be limited by our own technology as to what we could possibly learn as well.
Wow. So let me thank the folks in Dr. Tyson Hardy's. So what is this called? Is this a science enrichment class? I mean, it must be if you've got freshmen in there who actually took time to listen to us drone on about the standard model. I'm very impressed. And thank you so much for participating, folks. You guys asked some really good questions.
Yeah, great questions.
But we've reached that point in the program that we like to call, what have we learned? Holy smokes, I've learned a lot. So so basically, the standard model, right, and sort of the last key in that puzzle, the last important one, was the existence of the Higgs boson. Is really sort of like a periodic table for subatomic particles.
Uh-huh.
And this is a great example of the reductionist nature of science, right? So we have the periodic table for chemistry. We've got the taxonomy classifications of animals for zoology, biology. And actually, I believe Dr. Hardy is a zoologist by training. But he knew a lot about particle physics.
Or the base nuclides in DNA.
Yeah, exactly, right. So this is a way to reduce it to some basic interacting concepts, particles, ideas, fields, and things like that. And now that we've discovered the Higgs boson, the interesting thing is, does it have all the properties that would be consistent with the standard model?
That's right.
If so, the standard model, which people, you know, the supersymmetry folks, they've been trying to wail on this thing for years, may hang around for quite some time. Or if it has different properties, it might suggest some of these other interesting theories.
That's right.
Right. And basically what it does is breaks it down into two different types of particles, sort of quarks and leptons, sort of the heavy and the light particles in terms of subatomic particles. And Peter Higgs was the guy who really is credited with coming up with this mechanism, right? And this mechanism that describes the interaction between the Higgs field and the Higgs boson and describes how everything else has to have some kind of mass. Well, a lot of these particles have to have mass. And the whole God particle thing, you know, there are different stories. Either it comes out of the frustration of physicists with this particle, or other people have said, well, it's the particle that unifies everything, so we'll call it the God particle. But really not an apt name. So any weird stuff you read in the popular media about, well, we've discovered the God particle, you don't have to go to church anymore. Kind of an irrelevant discussion. But it's an example of very interesting discoveries coming out of these really expensive physics experiments like the CERN Large Hadron Collider and all its other things there. Beyond the Hadron Collider, there are lots of different machines there that do all sorts of interesting things. I was disappointed to find out that Fermilab has shut down its main reactor. But that just means we all get to go to Switzerland, which
That's
should be
right.
good. It's a very short-lived particle, 10 to the minus 24th seconds in its lifetime, and maybe we're still trying to figure out why it is so short-lived. And it may have some relevance to sort of the newcomers in terms of theoretical physics. That's dark matter and dark energy, which are the new, and I must say, a good marketing name for the fudge factor to describe the stability of galaxies and the rate at which we're expanding. And I'm an engineer. We use fudge factors all the time. Right. So to me, fudge factor is a totally reasonable thing. You guys at least market it well by calling it dark matter and dark energy. And remember that for our high school students listening. I believe it was Harry Kroto, the Nobel laureate, who was on our program once, who said, look, the key to getting famous in science is not only discovering something really interesting and really unique, but giving it a cool name.
That's right.
And this is the guy who describes, you know, symmetric C60 cages as Buckminster Fullerene. Mm-hmm. So a cool name is important as well. So thanks so much to our students up in Jasper County. Mark, thanks so much for being on the program.
Okay, thank you guys for being here.
Yeah, and if you've got a question or comment about this program or a suggestion for a future show, by all means send us an email at comments at insidetheblackbox.org. Our chief engineer is Trent Altman. Our theme music is composed and performed by Bill and Mary Hunt. And we want to thank our good friend Warren Matthews for hooking us up with the Jasper County School System today. And we are a production of the WREK Studios here on the campus of the Georgia Institute of Technology. Please join us next week for Inside the Black Box, science only funnier.